Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says this year's hay crop will be the worst in decades because of the drought. Hay is already in short supply, and prices have spiked. Willow Belden reports that the hay shortage is forcing ranchers to make tough choices and could have a lingering economic impact on the state's ag industry.
The Flying Y Ranch is nestled beneath the Snowy Range Mountains just west of Laramie. About 300 cows graze on the open meadows. They always eat grass in the summer, but this year, the grass isn't doing well. Rancher Ryan Kelly says last year at this time, the fields were lush and green.
We're still underwater this time of year, pretty close. You know, mid-July, 1st of August, we still had water standing out in some of the meadows.
This year, those meadows are brown and parched. So little grass has grown that they haven't been able to cut any hay, which means there isn't enough forage to get the cows through the winter.
And if you don't have enough, you either have to buy hay or sell cows.
Kelly says they considered buying hay, but it's just too expensive. Prices have about doubled since last year.
I've heard hay prices anywhere clear up to $350 a ton. You know, figuring 20 to 30 pounds per cow per day turns into a lot of money.
And that's if you can get hay at all. Many producers are only harvesting about one-third as much hay as usual, and some haven't produced any. Neighboring states don't have much hay available either because the drought has hit them too. So Kelly's ranch is going with the second option, selling off cattle. They've already sold about 30 cows and they'll likely unload another 50 in October. That's nearly three times as many as they sell in a normal year. And Kelly is not alone. Ranchers across Wyoming and the West are downsizing their herds. For many, it's because of the hay shortage, but that's not the only problem. At Orville Johnson's ranch, northeast of Laramie, the main concern is drinking water. Johnson points out a creek that meanders through one of his fields. This is where the cows usually drink, but this year there's no water, only a bed of cracked mud. Johnson says normally it would look very different.
It would be running anywhere from 6 inches to a foot. Right there where we would cross it would have been about 2 foot deep probably. And it's just, as you can see, it's just dry.
Johnson says there are still a few holes with water, but they'll be dry soon, and then he'll have to turn to well water. Typically, he wouldn't do that until the creeks freeze up in the winter.
Starting the wells this early, we don't know if they're going to go dry or not, because they're all kind of shallow, hand-dug or backhoe-dug wells.
Johnson has already sold some cows, and he says if the wells go dry, the entire herd will have to go. Luckily for the ranchers, cattle prices are still reasonably high, but even so, downsizing a herd is bad for business. Dallas Mount is an extension agent in Platte County. He says the financial impact of a drought is most apparent in the years following the drought.
When you sell off livestock, what that means is cash revenue. So this year, you know, you might be able to pay all your bills and get things done, but what you sold off was your factory. So next year, if we get grass and the grass grows, well, you're not going to have as many calves to sell. So you're going to have to hold back heifer calves to rebuild that herd. So that means you'll have even fewer calves to sell. And typically that rebuilding takes about 3 years.
That's three hard years for ranchers and three hard years for hay producers. Todd Fornstrom grows hay in Pine Bluffs near the Nebraska border. He's one of the few hay producers who's had a pretty good year. That's because he has enough well water to irrigate his fields, so his crop is fine and getting a good price for the product is easy.
Hay usually has different grades where dairy hay is the high quality all the way down to feeder hay. And this year it really doesn't matter a lot. As long as it's nice and green and somebody can feed it, it's worth a lot of money.
But he says hay prices won't stay high in the future if too many ranchers sell off their livestock.
If you want to sell hay, you don't want people selling livestock. What it will do is it'll curb demand, and demand is hard to get back.
Plus, a reduction in livestock can be bad for the state's overall economic picture.
Cattle production, livestock production in Wyoming affects not only the rancher, but the local communities also, the guys on Main Street, basically.
That's Tex Taylor, an ag economist at the University of Wyoming. He says when ranchers unload livestock, businesses like feed stores, gas stations, veterinarians, and mechanics all suffer. Still, many Wyoming ranchers say they can make it through one bad year. But if next year is equally dry, they say times ahead could be very tough.
Earlier this year, we told you about an effort to turn coal into gas in Medicine Bow. Today, DKRW Advanced Fuels has announced that it has secured a contract to its Medicine Bow project with Sinopec Engineering Group, that's based out of China. Bob Kelly is a co-founder and executive chairman of DKRW, and he tells me that getting an actual bid on the facility puts wheels in motion.
And it's not just the price, it's a substantive company behind it that has the scale, the balance sheet, and the skill set, because Sinopec has built these in China. And this, of course, gives the international banking community confidence that, A, it'll get built, there'll be guarantees that it'll be completed, and it's one of the critical cornerstones for the financing of the project. It's a big step. It enables us to now go to the banking and the equity, international banking and equity community, lay out the project economics, and our target is to finalize financing by the end of the year and the first quarter of 2013, in that time frame. And once that's done, then you're going into construction.
Let me ask you about this. So when we've talked with you in the past, I know you've been always cautiously optimistic. I mean, is this now full-blown optimism that this thing's going to happen?
Well, I think it's a big step. And it's a, you know, I mean, if you think about it, you know, here's a facility that's a large facility, and you have a large company that's stepping in after they've done their own worldwide procurement, because they're not going to give us a price till they go out to all their suppliers, and we're talking about thousands of components here, and bid those out, get those prices, and then enter those into a contract with us that says we'll guarantee by this date you'll have the facility built for this price. So it's a big step. Yeah, I'm optimistic that you know, we're going to be successful at raising our financing and into construction in the time frame that I talked about.
I'm curious of one of your thoughts, too, before I let you go. You know, there's so much being talked about the EPA and maybe the future of coal. As with this news, are you finding that folks in Wyoming, especially maybe some of our leaders, are a little more interested in this project than maybe we've seen in the past, just because, you know, coal is under threat and this could be one of those potential solutions?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is what, so it's not, and it's not just in Wyoming, it's across the country. I mean, this is a project that produces gasoline with, first of all, ultra-low sulfur, you know, meeting all the low sulfur requirements. But the carbon, the CO2 footprint of this gasoline is as competitive as any other gasoline that's produced in the refining mix in the United States. So it's as clean as you can get it produced. It's done from coal. It's done competitively, and it's a new market for coal. You know, we, as coal plants get, as it becomes more difficult to meet requirements on coal plants, here's a use of coal that enables a high-value added product, gasoline, chemicals, to be produced in a way that is very environmentally benign. You know, it's an important step, and not only in Wyoming does it, you know, add a market, but it also develops the value added in the state. You know, you're not just shipping coal out to a power plant in you know, in some other state or shipping it to another market. What you're doing is using it in the state, adding a lot of value added, bringing jobs in the state, tax revenues, and investment. And frankly, you know, it's a worldwide center of excellence on clean coal technology involving chemicals and transport fuel. So for the University of Wyoming and for really the whole industry, having this facility in place will be a magnet for interest from international concerns that want to see how it's done, and I think it'll bring a lot more to Wyoming than just, you know, the gasoline that we're producing. It'll bring, you know, development of these technologies, development of chemicals, and other related technologies, as well as looking into more, you know, detailed engineering and competitive ways to do carbon capture and sequestration, to use coal in a clean way that meets the environmental requirements of the future. So it's a big deal.
Bob Kelly is the executive chairman of DKRW. Nice to chat with you again, and thank you for joining us.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and have a good day.
When we come back, we'll visit with the Wyoming Cowgirls volleyball team, which is on the rise, and we'll talk with author Jennifer Woodleaf about her new book, A Bolt from the Blue. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. We're joined now by author Jennifer Woodleaf. She recently published a new book about a particularly disastrous climbing accident in the Tetons. The book is called A Bolt from the Blue, and it describes the accident and the ensuing rescue operation. So Jennifer, without giving too much away, tell us about this accident.
Well, it was an absolutely phenomenal rescue, one of the most sensational ones in the history of American mountaineering. It was a group of 13 amateur climbers who were trying to summit the Grand Teton in 2003. They were struck by a single bolt of lightning late in the afternoon in late July, and what ensued at that point was just a phenomenal rescue by the Jenny Lake Park Rangers, who had to come in short hauling, hanging 100 feet from a rope at the bottom of a helicopter, inserting themselves into the scene at the top of the mountain, 13,000 feet plus, in the midst of a storm, and save everybody that they could.
What made you want to write this book?
I think that the rescue heroes of Jenny Lake are some of the most phenomenal men in the country in terms of their ability to be selfless and heroic, but completely shun the limelight. It was actually difficult to get some of them to talk to me because they do not want press attention or any kind of accolades for what they do. They're just doing their job and saving people. And in this case, one of the rangers told me he didn't think it would be a good story because it was such a flawless rescue. And I said, that, in fact, I thought that was what would make it an amazing story. And the history of their training and everything that got them to that point to work together as a team was what made this just an absolutely phenomenal situation.
Right, and much of the book obviously centers around these rangers, these rescue heroes, as you called them, and these are, of course, the Jenny Lake Climbing Rangers, and these are not your typical park rangers. Tell us a little bit about them.
They're not. They do have some park duties as well, and they do have some law enforcement duties, a few of them, but for the most part, they have specialized training in high-altitude rescue, in climbing rescues, hiking accidents. They have an absolutely amazing short-haul program, which I referenced earlier, where they get themselves inserted into the scene, dangling from a helicopter so that they can reach into places that are treacherous or extremely sheer that they might otherwise would take them hours to climb to. The helicopter pilot can actually just drop them into the scene. They can put the victims into a basket or hang them with them on the short-haul line and get them out to the hospital much quicker. So they have unbelievably amount of specialized training, EMT training. It's a really rigorous training program, and they're some of the best climbers in the world.
How did you get them to talk to you? I mean, as you said, they don't tend to like a lot of attention, but yet you got a lot of detail about sort of their everyday duties, their lives, and, of course, about this rescue. You obviously managed to get a lot of information about them, which I can imagine took many hours of interviews. What sort of finally made them say, okay, I'm willing to talk?
It did. I tend to over-interview and interview more people than I need and then end up over-researching and cutting at the end. But here, I had a little bit of credibility due to a guy named Lanny Johnson, who was a ski patrolman in my second book, which is about an avalanche in Lake Tahoe. And he had been a Jenny Lake Park Ranger long before this accident. So he gave me the first initial introductions. That sort of opened the door. And then from then, I had to prove myself in terms of I gave them copies of my previous book so that they could see that I would treat action-adventure stories with a level of respect and sensitivity, that I wrote about tragedies not in a way to sensationalize them, but just to tell the story straight out. So I think that helped. And then a couple of them were still reluctant, and I actually had Rennie Jackson help me ambush one of the rangers. He kept ducking my calls and didn't want to meet, and Rennie said, well, I'll take care of this for you. And he got on the radio, and he said, you know, Jack, report right now to the rescue cache. And I think he thought it was a rescue in progress, and he showed up, and there I was. And he's like, oh. So he ended up having to, you know, talk to me, and he spent 3 or 4 hours with me and was absolutely wonderful and charming and extraordinarily helpful.
Well, that's quite a way to get somebody to talk to you. Looking sort of at the other side of the picture here, your book doesn't just follow the rangers. It paints a pretty detailed picture of what happened to the climbers, you know, from their point of view. I can imagine that that must have been hard, interviewing these climbers and sort of asking them to revisit what must be very traumatic memories. How did that go?
It certainly was. I mean, they're faced with almost an impossible choice, and I realize that I'm putting them in it, and I try to be as absolutely as supportive and sensitive as possible. Their choice is sort of to either relive the worst time of their life or to risk me getting it wrong, or maybe even worse, sort of leaving it out. And I think in the end, they determined that they did want readers to get to know sort of their loved ones and themselves and what it was like for them. And everybody always ends up, in the course of talking, wanting to almost finding it cathartic to talk about the entire event. But I did get extraordinarily lucky that everybody I approached was willing to talk to me.
What lessons do you want readers to take away from this book? I mean, obviously, this isn't really an instance where the climbers were unprepared or where they did something particularly wrong. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong weather, but that could sort of happen to anybody. So what's sort of the takeaway message?
Well, I don't think there's any sort of, like, you know, tips for what to do. I mean, all things being equal, it was probably a little bit later in the day than they should have been on the mountain. And they had realized that, actually, and they were in the process of retreating down the mountain. They had to climb up Friction Pitch to go down, but they were doing that. They had abandoned their summit quest and had made a decision that safety was more important, which I think is definitely a takeaway here, that there wasn't summit fever and they had to reach the peak at all costs. They had done the right thing in terms of that. They just got extraordinarily unlucky with to being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think had it happened any place else in the country or even in the world, they might not have got so lucky with the rescue crew that they had. And I think if there's any particular tips there, these guys were absolutely phenomenal. And the description of the rescue and the timing and the tightness with darkness closing in and the helicopter needing to be grounded within moments is just an absolutely spectacular story.
Now I have to ask, are you a climber?
I did some very beginning climbing just to get a little bit of credibility, mostly in the Tahoe area, so that I could know some of the terminology and get a little bit of credibility that way. But no, I'm not, and I did get some pushback at the beginning that a non-climber can't write about climbing. So far what I've heard is that I did, in fact, end up nailing the climbing sections.
All right, well, Jennifer, thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
Jennifer Woodleaf's new book is called A Bolt from the Blue. The University of Wyoming Cowgirls volleyball team believes that this could be their year. 18 years after their last NCAA tournament appearance and coming off two strong seasons, the Wyoming squad believes it will take a big step forward this year. Bob Beck has more.
Wyoming actually has had some volleyball success, but that was many years ago. The Cowgirls appeared in three NCAA postseason tournaments in an 8-year period starting in 1986, and under Hall of Fame coach Mike English, Wyoming advanced to the Final Eight 1 year. There have been a few good teams, but Carrie Yerdy wants more than that. Yerdy is the Cowgirls' current head coach. She is tall, thin, and athletic-looking. She was a star college player at Washington State, where she was named to a Pac-10 All-Decade team. As a head coach, she later had several good teams at Memphis before coming to Wyoming in 2008. But that first year was tough. Wyoming only won 5 games versus 20 losses, and the next year was a 13-18 squad. But Yerdy says while those teams were young, they changed everything.
I'm telling you, those kids from the first 2 years gave me their heart and soul, and that's why our program's been able to grow so fast, is because they really sold something that they believed in, and that was awesome. I tell people it was the Lord brought me here. I have no other explanation.
That's Jody Purdy. Every team has a star, and on this very good team, Purdy is Wyoming's star. She is the preseason Mountain West Conference Co-Player of the Year, and many believe she will be Wyoming's first volleyball All-American in over 20 years. Purdy was heavily recruited and surprised many by picking Wyoming, but after meeting players from that 5-20 team, she knew Laramie was where she wanted to be.
When I came on my visit, I really loved the vision that they had for this program, and that was one of my desires, was to come in and make an impact for a program. And not only have I felt I've done that for the program, but the program has definitely impacted me as well.
With Purdy on the team, Wyoming eventually had back-to-back 20-win seasons. But when the Cowgirls upset nationally ranked Colorado State last year, she knew Wyoming had finally arrived.
That's when it was a big turning point for our team, was when we beat CSU, and wow, like, this is a good team, and if we beat a good team, that must mean we're a good team. And our confidence was through the roof, and we were just so excited about the possibilities for our team and stuff.
Coach Yurdy says after that match, she saw a change in her team, and it led to other big wins.
The more often we got on the court, the better we got, and we never really had a valley. We just kept getting better and better and better.
Her players say that match helped, but a lot of that confidence comes from their coach. Camille Kaufman has played for Yurdy for 4 years.
Now she just has a swag about her. Like, she knows we're good, and when we walk into the gym, she expects teams to be scared of us and expects us to win.
Do you have that same attitude when you walk in?
Yeah, I do. Carrie's talked to us a lot about we're finally at that point as a program where we know we're good and we know that we can get some big wins.
Yurdy says there is a reason she is confident.
I believe in their work ethic. I believe in the effort that they give me every day. I've got a team that carries a 3.6-something GPA. To me, that's amazing. Those kids, not only are they smart and dedicated in the classroom, but on the court, those characteristics carry over.
And the hope is that carries over into something special, like an NCAA tournament appearance. As the Cowgirls warm up during their opening match of the season, Chris and Barb Gunther are watching as usual. The Gunthers are two fans who have closely followed the Cowgirls for 30 years, and they are cautiously optimistic.
This team is good. It is good.
In the last 15 years, this is hands down the best team we've had here. We haven't had a really successful team since the Mike English era, and this is a team that really looks like it could do just as well as that team did.
Coach Yurdy says when she came to Wyoming, she had a 5-year plan. This is the 5th season, and practices have been intensified and the schedule has been beefed up with one goal in mind.
Clearly, the NCAA tournament for the 5th year is the apple in the sky, I guess. It's the piece that we're reaching to grab for, and you know, we'll shoot for the moon, and if we fail, we'll grab a star on the way down.
Yurdy and the players admit that falling short of the NCAA tournament would be a disappointment. But for now, the Wyoming Cowgirls don't act like a team that plans to be disappointed. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, we'll take a look at Wyoming's gender wage gap, and we'll talk with the head of Wyoming's AFL-CIO. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Paul Farmer and Ophelia Dahl, who founded the group Partners in Health, will be speaking in Jackson on September 6th. Partners in Health is a nonprofit that provides health care to impoverished people around the world. They started in Haiti in 1987 and now work in 10 different countries. Ophelia Dahl joins us now to talk about their work. She says the basic approach is to partner with local governments to do a few different things.
One of them is to train clinicians and healthcare workers, and another is to help rebuild infrastructure and to really help to build a platform on which healthcare is possible.
Obviously, there are lots of organizations around the world that have similar missions, trying to bring medical care to people in need. What's particularly different about Partners in Health? What sets you apart?
I would say what sets us apart is the partnerships in Partners in Health. I think that we feel that it's absolutely necessary for us not to be a single NGO that's off working on its own, however passionate and committed, but really we're working hard to forge partnerships, whether it's with the government, which is really does set us apart, to work with governments and to really strengthen health systems for the future. And I think that's what we feel will build lasting change.
One of the things that is interesting about you guys is that the sort of premise is that in order to get people better access to health care, you have to do more than provide just health care. You have to sort of address the reasons why people aren't getting the care they need, you know, taking on issues like poverty, mm-hmm. small things like that. How do you go about doing that?
Well, you know, just to give a bit of history, we just found it so very difficult to really build a platform of healthcare and not address the social determinants of disease. So, you know, being able to make sure that patients had access to clean water and food and shelter. But the truth is, it's actually quite difficult for an NGO to do this, and you really do need partners to be able to get those pieces done well. But I think even being a group that says, in order to provide healthcare, in order to make a population healthier, you need to address these other pieces, is a really important thing to claim, because it's otherwise you're going to have a population that is really unable to take care of itself because it's struggling with the other things that are keeping them down.
Obviously, you guys started in Haiti and then branched out to other countries, and now, as you mentioned, you're operating on multiple continents. How different are the challenges that you face in all these places? I mean, can a single approach work here?
Yeah, and I think it's not that single. I think that I think it's tailored for everything from the political situation to, you know, certain cultural aspects of the countries in which we're working. But on the whole, poverty is poverty. Lack of access to modern medical care is the same. It's very similar. Now, it might be that we're working in a very mountainous region in Lesotho, so the methods that you employ to get to patients or get your patients to clinic, you know, is slightly different. But in the end, making sure that people have access to dignified, decent medical care is really what these folks living in countries without access are looking for.
I'm curious what it was like operating in Haiti after the earthquake.
How long have you got? Working in Haiti after the earthquake was incredibly challenging in ways that I'd never imagined it could be, and I know I speak for my colleagues. It was also incredibly heartening to be working with a group of our own colleagues who were in many ways so well placed to be able to go into action immediately. You know, having a workforce, a trained workforce in Haiti of everything from pharmacists to surgeons, to be able to respond and not have to wait till, you know, people could fly down to get things going. So our, you know, supply chain and all of that was up and going, so that when we did get surgeons and teams and medical teams and nurses and anesthesiologists down there, we were in many ways in some of our clinics and hospitals ready to go. The other part of it that was, you know, was very important, I think, speaks to the bigger piece of the work going forward, is that there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of nonprofits and groups and crisis organizations that came in to help. Coordinating all of that was very challenging. I know it was challenging for the Haitian government that had already itself been decimated by the losses, because this hit Port-au-Prince, where the majority of the civil service worked. So it was a huge challenge, and yet it was also very moving to see everybody go into action and to see the folks in that country, the Haitians and our colleagues, be able to pull together. The really difficult emotional side of this is, you know, I think it still lingers with many people, many of our colleagues there. Of course, it's not even 3 years, and I know many of our colleagues who lost family members are still deeply affected by this, but also I think comforted by the knowledge that we were able to get stuff done as a team and to see the response of North Americans. Almost half of all American households gave to the relief work after the earthquake in Haiti. That's pretty phenomenal, and I think it says something about American people.
I wanted to ask about something that you touched on here, the emotional aspect for you and your colleagues. I mean, I can imagine that can be emotionally draining to be seeing what you're seeing and dealing with what you're dealing with. How do you and your colleagues sort of handle that and manage not to kind of get depressed by what you're seeing?
I think the key is us and our colleagues. I think in part it's the teamwork piece of this. If some people are down, the other people can boost you. I think it's having specific goals in mind. It's seeing progress towards those goals. This does feel like work that is never finished, and you know, sometimes it can feel like a really Herculean task, but it also feels very, very heartening to be able to affect change. I think for me, to look at conditions in front of you and know that you're part of a team and part of a bigger system that can actually change that piece of suffering or that on a broader level in front of you, that's the part that feels really good.
All right. Well, Ophelia Dell, Executive Director of Partners in Health, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The gender wage gap in Wyoming is the largest in the nation, and that's not news either. It's been this way for years. Groups around the state are working to fix it through policy, training programs, and education. But Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhoroff reports that it could be the state's industries that keep the gap firmly in place.
The wage gap, when calculated using full-time, year-round wages for women and men, is 65 cents on the dollar in Wyoming. That means for every dollar a Wyoming man earns, a woman earns just 65 cents. The national average is 77 cents on the dollar.
Jobs that are traditionally female, so for instance, teachers or nurses, are paid below the national average, and jobs that are traditionally male, for instance, construction work, are paid above the national average.
That's Executive Director of the Wyoming Women's Foundation, Rochelle Kyneth. According to a report the foundation released in 2011, even in traditionally female professions, men get paid significantly more than women. That's because even within a field, men and women are often not working the same jobs. Director of Wyoming Department of Workforce Services, Joan Evans, says there's another big issue, too.
Some of it can be attributed to the types of occupations that we have here in the state. Because we are very industrial, very energy-oriented, a lot of those positions are held by men and traditionally not held by women.
Traditionally male professions like mining, construction, and manufacturing make up about 25% of the state's jobs. And those are jobs, says Evans, that women often can't do.
Let's use truck driving as an example. If you're a single mom, you are not going to be able to do over-the-road trucking. You may be able to take a job as a truck driver that is limited to a particular area, but you're going to want to not be on call. You're going to want to be close to home in case there's an emergency with your kids.
Matt Garland, owner and partner in North Star Energy and Construction, employs 15 women among his 380 employees.
Our standard work day on truck driving is usually 11 hours a day, and it can go up to 6 days a week, and it's not always at home. It takes a support system for their kids, getting them to and from daycare. So it is very hard in this industry for ladies to fit that schedule.
Garland says he'd hire more women if they applied.
I know that the ladies that we do have and the ones that come on are very good employees. They have a few issues maybe with kid care and stuff like that, but they do a heck of a good job.
He also says only his female employees come to him with child care issues. Most of the women Garland has hired completed a training program through Climb Wyoming, a nonprofit that helps single mothers get well-paying work. Climb Wyoming focuses on workforce needs in specific areas and trains women to fill those gaps.
Until these training programs started up to train them in this heavy equipment and also truck driving and stuff, they just didn't have the experience to do it, so they usually didn't apply.
There are other initiatives, too. The legislature has increased teachers' wages, which is a field dominated by women. There's a nursing workforce center in the works to help nurses, also a predominantly female occupation, streamline their education. There are Leap into Leadership workshops to help women get into leadership positions, and STEM education to encourage women to pursue high-paying fields, like engineering, while they're in school. But the child care issue is an important one. Rochelle Kyneth of the Wyoming Women's Foundation again.
The cost of child care is prohibitive for some, so it just makes more sense to stay home than to be able to work and have their child cared for in a facility where they feel like they're getting the education or the care that they need. So access to quality child care, affordable quality child care is a huge piece of the issue for women's access to work.
The foundation did a study that found that just the extractive industries, along with support industries, widened the gap by 7 cents. Making those workplaces more flexible could help narrow it. But some of the work rests with women themselves. Workforce Services' Joan Evans says this.
I guess if I had any advice, it would be if, as women, you know, if we're in a position to say, I am of value to you, employer, please value the service that I can contribute equally to what you would value a male's contribution, and take that opportunity to negotiate.
The Wage Project runs workshops to train women how to negotiate effectively. Katie Boysen used to give these workshops all over the state.
Women simply don't ask for raises, and that's a large part of why we have this wage gap.
Boysen says that's an attitude that has stagnated in the state along with the wage gap.
I did it with a group of students in Casper College, both boys and girls, and it was really interesting because you think we're, you know, really modern and, you know, college-age girls, they're not going to have any problem. But they did, and to the boys, it was almost like a joke. They had no problems.
Boysen says women are socialized not to talk about money. In Wyoming, the wage gap now is where the national average was in the 1980s. During a recession like now, it tends to narrow. But that's because men are getting fired more, not because women are getting paid more. When hiring starts up again, the state may see if it's progressed any closer to where it should be. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
It's Labor Day weekend, which means there will be a lot of discussion surrounding workers in the state. Kim Floyd is the executive secretary of the labor organization, the AFL-CIO. He says it's an interesting time for many workers.
Here in Wyoming, we have done pretty well through this recession. Our unemployment rate has been relatively really low compared to the rest of the country.
Are you satisfied with the wages you hear about and see out there?
You know what? Within organized labor, the wages are pretty competitive, and we negotiate for those wages, and we negotiate at a collective bargaining table with our employers. And I think they've held up. One of the things that have really cost us in, over the years is the cost of health care. And there's been a lot of times when we've been at the bargaining table where we've had to give up what raises that actually put more money into our pockets, and we've had to put those gains toward our health care premiums. And so there has been a stagnation there on wages because of that issue. But overall, within organized labor, we've done really well. Outside of organized labor, I don't think they've fared so well.
The health care issue seems to be a big one out there.
Let's face it, we have to have health care. You know, it just takes one really bad accident or one thing to happen within a family unit, and if you don't have health care, you can literally bankrupt a family.
Hey, Kim Floyd visiting with us again from the AFL-CIO here in Wyoming. You know, we don't have, as you well know, a slew of unions or representation in the state, and yet the few that you see and hear about, every now and then they get on the headlines, and there is a, you know, attempts to break those kinds of things down. Are there attempts like we're seeing in other states to come after some of the labor unions in our state?
Well, there are, and you know, we saw a couple that surfaced from a representative down in Casper last year, Tea Party type representative, and he came after collective bargaining for all public employees. And first of all, the only people that have collective bargaining in the state of Wyoming, if you're a public employee, are the firefighters. We get that. It trickles down with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They do legislation, and they have big meetings, and they send this legislation around every state, and it does trickle down. But for the most part, you know, we were able to defeat that soundly. here in the state of Wyoming. We are a right-to-work state, as you've alluded to, and I think it's pretty much a moot issue here in the state, but it still will serve us with this, all the things that are going on politically across the country.
One thing we've obviously talked an awful lot about is workplace safety issues over the last few years. And you know, you see a stride every now and then in this regard. But, Kim, it's got to be of concern to you when you read about some of the happenings in places like Sinclair and know that still our workplace safety issues out there, no matter what they may be, are extremely serious. Are you feeling like there might be a turning of the corner anytime soon, or what's your thoughts right now?
Well, it is an incredibly important issue to Wyoming, Bob. I mean, we've been number one in the country, I think, 8 out of the last 10 years on death and accidents on the job. And to us, absolutely, totally unacceptable. Some of the things we've done, though, and I do have some optimism in that there were some really big strides, I think, made last year. And those, as you know, Bob, where we were able to, first of all, convince the governor that the problem was real and it existed. And when it came down to find the money that would fund these positions, we were able to use workers' comp funds, which by constitution we were allowed to go get those funds.
Yeah, and you're talking about the new OSHA positions.
Right, the new OSHA positions. And we were able to get that money to create 7 new positions in OSHA. Right now, before we were able to do that, there were only 4 inspectors in the state, and they covered tens of thousands of employers. I think the statistics on them were that if they had gone out and inspected everybody that fell under OSHA, it'd take them 65 years. So we were able to get those 7 positions. We were able to get some money out of the workers' comp. And by the way, Bob, the workers' comp has $1.4 billion in it. It wasn't like we were raiding a fund that was going broke. This fund is very, very healthy today, and we were able to use those funds to our advantage and to the employer's advantage, because nobody wins when we have accidents on the job. So there's some grant money available there to employers. We hope they use it. $10,000 to an employer that will either start up a safety program or buy safety equipment and make us safer on the job. And we have a long way to go here in the state of Wyoming. We have a lot of dangerous industries in the state of Wyoming. But we'll just have to wait and see. And we'll certainly, if this doesn't work, if this doesn't start curbing these deaths, we're going to have to start looking at tougher penalties here in the state of Wyoming.
Kim, I always need to have more time for you. It's always a good conversation. Kim Floyd of the AFL-CIO here in Wyoming. Happy Labor Day, and thank you for joining us on Open Spaces.
Hey, thank you, Bob.
When we come back, we'll hear about hunting carp with a bow and arrow. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming fisheries no longer stock state waterways with carp, but the species is still alive and well throughout the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez filed this end-of-summer postcard about her first experience with the common carp and with bow fishing.
For the unskilled archer, shooting a carp, even a massive one, with a bow and arrow is no easy task. I learned that firsthand this summer during an afternoon of bow fishing at Wheatland Reservoir No. 3.
Nuts.
It's no easier with a bow and arrow, and its accoutrements made for the left-handed archer. Now, I'm not much of an archer, but I'm definitely not left-handed. So why was I playing with ill-suited weapons in algae-filled water at a beach covered with cows in their paddies? My friend Janet Chen, a fit and proper young lady whom I know by her nickname, Ogre, invited me. I don't often turn down a bizarre-sounding adventure. Here's Ogre.
I like to shoot things and hunt, and it's nice that I get to do it in water where it's nice and cool, and nobody cares about carp, and so I don't really have to feel that bad about killing them.
Ogre explained that unlike game trout, the carp just live in the reservoir. There are plenty of them, and her friends use the carcasses in their gardens and under new trees and shrubs. I called the Wyoming Game and Fish Department to ask about this. Regional fisheries biologist Steve Gale says fisheries used to stock the waterways with the hardy common carp.
What they thought back in the day is that they're going to be kind of a popular food fishery, and just that kind of never really panned out. So they're in a lot of waterways, and they can provide a lot of sport on your hook and line as well. They can get to enormous sizes and can really put a tug on your line.
Unlike trout, the carp aren't considered game fish. You need a fishing license to harvest them with a line, but not if you're using a bow and arrow. I wasn't much good at hunting bottom feeders, so I passed the bow and arrow to Ogre and took a break. Within two shots from the land, Ogre hit her target, so I sprinted over as she hauled an enormous 15-pound carp onto the shore.
It's huge.
It was almost the size of a cat and flapping with all its muscle. Ogre raised her axe and aimed it.
So the way I kill them is with the blunt side. I just take a golf swing to the head.
She braced the fish with her foot, then pulled the barbed arrow from the carp's side the way it went in.
And so this is the hard part.
I had every intention of stringing the carp while Ogre went into the water to bag a second fish, but I completely chickened out. So Ogre strung up the fish, and I hauled the 15-pound monster back to her truck. I brought the carp to my neighbor, Roger Goldfinger, to use in his compost pile. Now, this might sound wrong to you. I'm no gardener, and even I've heard you're not supposed to mix meat with compost. So I later called Craig McComey of the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality. He oversees recycling for the state and, by proxy, composting. He reminded me of the story of the 17th century Patuxet tribal member Tisquantum. Many Americans know him as Squanto and have heard how he helped immigrants from Europe.
And what they did back in the day was the soils where the pilgrims landed were not very good, and they weren't amenable to growing crops. And so the Indians had showed them that if you throw a fish in the ground with your corn seeds, that the corn seed would grow better.
He says fish are a pretty awesome source of nitrogen, but as my neighbor Roger soon found out, it can still be difficult to use them in compost.
I didn't know what a carp was. I thought a carp was the size of maybe a trout or something, you know, under 10 inches, maybe a little bit fatter. So when I saw this thing in my yard, I freaked out.
The huge fish scared his cat, too. In a rush to get rid of the enormous carp, he buried it in a shallow hole next to his compost pile, and that wasn't a good idea.
Later in the afternoon, as I was coming home, I see these birds gathered off in a corner, and sure enough, there's the carp. Its head now missing, and the birds picking at it. And then the next day, I dug a much deeper hole for it and finally buried it and put some rocks on top of it. And that seems to have kept it underground, at least, kept it from rising from the dead.
Had I asked him about it earlier, the DEQ's Craig McComey would have warned me about scavengers, which are way more attracted to fish meat than decomposing potato peels. He advised us to dig a deeper hole under the compost, cover it with mulch to disguise the fish smell, and maybe even build a fence around it next time. Roger assures me he is not interested in a next time. But if the stars align, Ogre plans to be out on the reservoir again next summer, bagging carp and bringing them back for her own friends, who are more than happy to take them off her hands. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and blockbuster information, you can follow us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.